Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and sitting, I'm sure, with bated breath, waiting to come in, is my friend John Rappaport. Hold on to your seats. I don't know where the show will fly today. John is a man full of information, honesty, and truth. But before inviting him onto the show, remember our conference is coming up April 26th, 27th, and 28th. Our conference means the conference of the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapies. We will be having a marvelous array of critics of conventional psychiatry, but an even more dominant theme will be better, happier alternatives for family life, for therapy, for helping kids, for helping adults, for working with veterans, for dealing with trauma. It's a great conference. I look forward to meeting some of my audience. I mean, you could give me great pleasure by coming up and saying, I've only heard you on your radio show. I'm so glad to meet you. April 26th, 27th, and 8th in Syracuse, New York. Not very expensive. The hotel's not that expensive, nor is the conference itself. This is not a money-making proposition. It's a labor of love. So April 26th, 27th, 28th, not too late. I think there are still some hotel blocks open to get the cheaper rate. So come, join us. You can find out about it on bregin.org, bregin.com, but also on empathictherapy.org. John, are you there?
I am, Peter. Great to be here with you.
You know, I hardly know how to introduce you other than to just say I've been on the radio on this man's show. He's been on my show. We have corresponded. Because of him, in large part, I now blog on naturalnews.com. It's a relationship that's just gone back and forth over the years around a mutual interest. John's a journalist. He has a website called No More Fake News.
That's right, No More Fake News.
I mean, it's fabulous. Has a publishing company, which I know nothing about, Truth Seekers. So I think one way to start this show, other than to just say that I love talking with John Rappaport, I really enjoy it, and I learn from him, is John, tell us about yourself. Introduce yourself to my audience.
Okay. Well, I started working as a reporter in 1982, writing articles for LA Weekly, newspaper in Los Angeles. And my interests at the beginning were somewhat political. I was kind of all over the map, covering lots of different issues. And then eventually, I became quite interested in writing stories on medical subjects, because I discovered that when I would read the newspapers, these medical reporters seemed to miss obvious points of logic and also never pressed the people they were interviewing with questions that went below the surface. They were taking all of their information from press officers at government institutions of research and corporations and so forth. And it just seemed, you know, ridiculous to me. And I just kind of had this interest in medical subjects. And then, of course, that moved into the area of psychiatry, which I knew a little bit about, but I began to put together a list, you might say. It was kind of a map of toxic drugs. And it didn't only include psychiatric drugs. There were all sorts of drugs on the list, medical drugs of one kind or another. And I began to see how pervasive this toxicity was all throughout society. And I guess that's how I really began to commit myself to doing further research in that area, because I could see what the effects were on people. I knew people who were taking these drugs, and it was doing them great harm, and yet somehow they thought that they ought to continue. That led to more research on the pharmaceutical industry, of course, and how they were marketing and selling drugs and literally inventing diseases and disorders in order to market and sell more drugs. And then we met in Los Angeles a couple of times, and I read your book, Toxic Psychiatry.
Well, when did we meet? That's got to be a long time ago.
I'm going to say that that was in the early 90s. You were out there to talk people.
God, I was doing the violence initiative.
Yeah, it was a kind of, and also you were lecturing and informing people in low-income city neighborhoods about experiments that were, you know, psychiatric experiments, and that they should watch out for all of this. We met at a hotel in West Los Angeles.
Remember now. God, I'd forgotten that. I was out there. I was actually talking in Watts. I met with leaders of the Crips and the Bloods to talk about keeping kids off all kinds of drugs.
And I walked in on a meeting that you were having with them at a hotel in West L.A.
I remember now.
You were just winding up the meeting, and everybody walked out, and we sat down and talked for a while. Yeah, that's when, you know.
Yeah. Just to catch up my audience, that was when Ginger and I were successfully conducting a campaign to stop the federal government from a giant program to go into the inner cities of America called the Youth Violence Prevention, and it was initiative, and it was the biological medical arm of it. They wanted to find biochemical and genetic markers in little inner city children, maybe even pre-birth, to show who was going to become violent and who wasn't. It was eugenics of the worst kind here in America. And we stopped that program. Ginger and I took a couple of years out of our lives and fought that thing and really, really stopped it in its tracks. One of our proudest moments. And now it's coming back to me meeting you at that point. And you can imagine how many people I was meeting at that point. It was quite a period of time.
Well, now, of course, in the wake of the Sandy Hook murders, Obama is saying that he wants to expand mental health community facilities all over America, which, of course, means more toxic drugs, diagnoses, and more killings and suicides and so forth as a result of those drugs. And then there is this brain mapping project, 10 years, over $1 billion already committed, to map the activity of the brain down to, you know, supposedly the last neuron. And the thing that anybody who has background in what psychiatry is really all about would be very disturbed by this idea, because although the PR on it is, of course, where this is all about disease research and curing Alzheimer's and this and that and the other thing, behind all of this is the traditional and eternal agenda of psychiatry, which is control, so that all of this research eventually will get funneled over into the area of, well, now that we understand the brain better, what can we do to control behavior, control activity of the brain? I was horrified to see that DARPA, which is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, that's sort of cutting-edge technology for the military and the Pentagon, they are involved right at the beginning of this brain mapping project, which tells you a great deal about where it's going to go. And this is something else that needs to be exposed, stopped in its tracks, before it can become yet another mechanism for the degradation of life.
This is so important. I think it would be worth spending time on. I have not taken this on. I'm aware of it. You know, it's so much like war where, you know, yeah, we're going to get some good, we're going to learn some good technology, but the basic intent is war. In this case, war on the so-called mentally ill for the profits of the pharmaceutical industry. Now, people are going to say, well, this is neuroscience. We're going to advance neuroscience. Well, maybe in the same sense that we advance technology during war, but the funding for this, the aim, the intent is not going to be understanding really how the brain works, which is we are at the barely at the edges of. It's going to be making up, continuing to make up false connections between brain and people's lives, their emotions, their feelings, their thoughts. That's what it's going to be, and it's going to be fake because we're so far away from that that the only useful neuroscience is really very basic science about connectivity in the brain that is far remote at this point from anything that's even like behavior. Does that make sense? Am I putting it
perfectly
there?
Yes, yeah, it makes perfect sense to me, and I wrote something to that effect in one of my articles, the fake aspect of this, because you can't do a research project for 10 years and then say truthfully, well, you know, we don't know much more than where we started. You know, and we're light years away from really knowing anything useful about the brain. But thanks for the $10 billion or $20 billion because
exactly. It
funded a lot of college educations for our kids and so forth. So you have to make it up. And exactly as you say, where you make it up is you begin to draw these supposed correlations between what's going on in the brain and human behavior, emotion, thought, etc., and disorders. You begin to invent a whole lot of new disorders that you haven't invented before, all to make yourself look good and useful. And at the same time, you're going to be, of course, as I said a minute ago, exercising more control over people's lives in the process. So yes, absolutely, there will be an enormous amount of faking, and that also takes place these days with what's called computer modeling or algorithms, where scientists invent highly technical explanations for a conclusion that they already want to reach. So they create these models and algorithms so that the end result will be, you know, what they started to shoot for. And only people who can understand this dense amount of mathematics will be able to perceive that it's all biased from the beginning. So I expect a great deal of this to be happening, and articles will be published, and public relations people will get news stories in the press about the progress of this and that and the other thing. But it will be another gigantic example of fakery.
I am so glad you brought this up. I haven't done a show about this. I've been remiss in terms of writing about it, and I'm glad you are. People can Google John Rappaport. It's JonRappaport. Did I get that right?
The last name is Rappaport.
Rappaport. Rappaport. And I know that. I'm blind when it comes to letters. This is so important, John. I'm so glad you brought it up. I actually got a book contract, which I later decided just wasn't what I wanted to do, on basically fake neuroscience. There's really two kinds of neuroscience going on right now. One is what we would call genuine science, which is you start with trying to figure out what you don't know. So in neuroscience, that might include things like, all right, we've got the, you know, I don't know what it is now, a dozen subtypes of serotonin receptors. Let's figure out what that means and how they connect to this and that, and how does it all affect the impulse going down the axon. Or we've got these different layers of electrical impulses being given off by the brain. Where do they come from? What parts of the brain? How do they change? Or on a highly theoretical level, maybe What are the operating systems we're dealing with here? They are not anything we've figured out yet. We don't know the software of this thing. We don't know the hardware of this thing. And that's neuroscience. That's where you start with what you don't know, and you begin to try to put things together. We're a million light years away from even, you know, Kepler or the very earliest astronomers trying to figure out how the physical world worked. The brain universe is infinitely more, your brain, my brain, infinitely more complex than the rest of the universe physically. No comparison. We don't have an Einstein of the brain. We don't have a Newton of the brain. We don't even have a Galileo of the brain. There are no great names of neuroscientists because no one as yet has given us a wow factor where we can say, well, we're really beginning to get somewhere here. So this is so important for people to grasp. And the influence, the amount of money that's poured in from the pharmaceutical industry is so huge that even the best neuroscience textbooks, which are really pretty pure neuroscience, are going to have a little chapter on psychiatry that's fake to go along with all the rest. So they'll have a little chapter on maybe schizophrenia has something to do with dopamine and blah, 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 when they've got to know it's untrue, but they're just doffing their hats to where all the money comes from. I'm so glad you're bringing this up, John.
Yeah.
Go some more.
Yeah, so then you have all of the rest of neuroscience, which is instead of trying to find out what you don't know, you assume that you already know something because it's going to be beneficial in terms of money or for other agendas to know it. So you make it up, and then you pretend that you've done the science that proves that you're right. And as I said, one of the ways that you can do this, and scientists are rapidly catching on to this in many fields, is you don't carry out what most people think of as scientific experiments, you know, where you have a hypothesis, you do empirical observation, and then you see whether what you have already predicted is going to happen does actually happen. And then if you are successful, other independent scientists use your methods and they see if they can confirm what you found. That's the way people are educated in the scientific method when they learn about it. But instead, the fakery science is, no, let's construct some sort of a highly sophisticated model that will be very hard to understand, that proves what we pretend we already know. And very few people will even understand what the model means. But we understand that there are people with a great deal of power, position, and money that want us to reach this particular conclusion that we are pretending to know about already. So we'll build our experiment to reach that conclusion, and then we will have more grant money. We will have more prestige. We'll have more promotions. We'll have all that we want out of life, but it'll be completely fake. That's, to me, what the rest of this science is really about.
Yeah, and it starts with where the money is. So it starts with, we know that there are mental illnesses, rather than, hey, people act and behave and think and feel in certain ways, and some of it works well and some doesn't. But we know there are mental illnesses, and we know they're brain-based and genetic-based. So now we're going to investigate the connections. Well, how do you investigate the connection when, A, we don't have a working model for brain function? We can't explain a thought, a feeling, or anything else. How are we going to explain a particular way of behaving or thinking? And secondly, we don't have any evidence that what we call psychiatric disorders have anything to do with the brain, rather than the software, the learning that people go through and experience in their lives. So on both ends, starting with the brain and then going to the so-called mental illness, it's a mythological construct in which anything seems to go. It just depends on what the fad is.
Exactly. Two things occur to me here. One is a statement that I found from a PBS Frontline program, which you may have seen, called Does ADHD Exist? And, of course, they interviewed all sorts of people, and they interviewed a professor out of Massachusetts, Russell Barkley, who has all sorts of impressive credentials. And they said to him, basically, look, we understand that there is no blood test for ADHD, so does it really exist? And his reply, paraphrasing it, was basically, people who say that just don't understand how science really works. They especially don't understand how science in our field of psychiatry works, because we don't need a blood test to say that ADHD exists. If we insisted on a blood test, there would be no such thing as any mental disorder, because we have no laboratory test of any kind for any mental disorder. So he just kind of, he blew the whistle completely on the entire, Bible of the 297 mental disorders, admitting there were no tests for any of them. But at the same time, I mean, in other words, no way to diagnose any of them. At the same time, claimed that still these people were doing science. It was just the rest of us that didn't understand what kind of science they were doing. Unbelievable.
Yeah, it makes so clear why critics like you and me, and those of us who are others that there are, why we're so threatening. Because the fact is, the thread we're pulling on unravels a huge intellectual, financial, government, insurance-supported framework that will tumble at one good tug if anybody looks at it. I really like the you're bringing this up. Can you have any more information on what this program is going to be like? I have only the little bits of hints. You've already, I think, told me more than I knew.
Well, it's the brain activity mapping, BAM, B-A-M. And the articles that announced it indicated that this would be universities, foundations, DARPA, as I mentioned earlier, the Pentagon technology arm, they would all be involved from the outset, as well as the National Institute of Mental Health, of course, which is, you know, all of their research is psychiatrically colored, and that this was going to be sort of the Manhattan Project of the brain, that this was 10 years committed with every indication that it would go on after that, that the funding from, at least according to the president's announcement, was something like $1.1 billion, and that was just initial funding. And this would be an all-out assault on learning everything there was to know about the brain. And it was clear that this project was already in the works. I mean, the plans had already been drawn up, and it was very convenient to announce it in the wake of the Sandy Hook murders, because everybody was convinced, that if we just say somebody is mentally ill, then everybody can relax and go home and just leave prevention of crime to the psychiatrist. So here was this announcement of the brain mapping project, as if to say, well, you see what we're doing now. We're really going to go into this and find out everything about it. So from everything I could glean, this was a major, major announcement. I mean, the intent was to bring everybody on board, you know, from the traditional areas that you would expect, and to collaborate, to cross reference their work, and to say, okay, we've got a decade here, we have to make significant advances, and get started, and let's go. That's the way it was presented.
Yeah, you know, it's this comes on top of the decade of the brain, and I'm now so old, I'm losing track of which decade that was. The decade of which decade was the decade of the brain? That was another brilliant PR campaign by psychiatry. And when the legislation was signed for the decade of the brain, of course, there was a psychiatrist right up there. Psychiatry was at the head of all of this. when in fact there are no connections that we know of between psychiatry and the brain, basically,
right.
Other than the treatments which damage the brain. Psychiatry really has nothing to do with the brain, as far as we know. We haven't proven any connections. Wow.
The other very ominous thing about this to me is, and I think people really need to understand this as well, I mentioned the National Institute of Mental Health would be very much involved in this project. Well, all you have to do is just read, go to Wikipedia and read about NIMH. And immediately, if you can stand back a little bit from it, you realize a few things. Number one, this is a government agency, a federal agency. This is paid for by tax dollars and by, whatever, the Treasury Department printing money. So this is federally approved, mandated, supported, funded, enforced wherever force is necessary. This is the federal government saying we are up to our necks in the subject of mental health and what that is, which has nothing to do with the Constitution. I mean, there is no provision anywhere that would indicate this for the slightest that the federal government should be involved at all. And then even worse, you see that the government is making an official definition that mental health is psychiatry, and it isn't anything else, because all of the researchers and all of the projects and all the money at NIMH is dedicated to psychiatric research and drug research. And this is a government-created and funded and enforced monopoly on the subject of what mental health actually is, which is absolutely preposterous and horrendous as soon as you kind of step back and take a look at it. But there it is.
This is so interesting. You know, we started talking about the Violence Initiative by chance that the Project Ginger and I managed to shut down. I think if I were in a different state of mind, I'd probably do what I did then, which is take 2 years out to try to stop this thing. But the Violence Initiative was simultaneous with the Genome Project. And the Genome Project funded a big conference. John, did I lose you then? I heard a noise.
No, I'm still here.
Oh, good. It funded a project for a conference at the University of Maryland that we got transformed. We shut it down, and then it was transformed. That was going to look into the genetics of violence. So here you have a conference, and that's exactly the kind of thing we're looking at on the genetics of violence, when there is no genetics of violence. So you postulate a genetics of violence, then you hold a conference on it, and at the same time you study inner-city children as a part of the same overall project. It's a very similar kind of phenomena. I hope that this radio show kind of gets people really thinking about this. And I know you've been writing about it. We've got about a minute before break. Can you tell folks where they can get the easiest way to get to your writings?
Yes, www.nomorefakenews.com. That has the links and the headlines for my blog articles. And once you're into the blog, you can scroll around and find everything. Also, you can Google my name and just simply type in a few words like brain mapping project, and you'll find these articles popping up. So that's the easiest way to get to it.
This is going to be a real tough one to do anything about, because nothing scientifically could be more important than understanding the brain scientifically. So here you've got this fundamental project of such great value that is going to be so corrupt, it's going to be hard to fight. John Rappaport, my guest, will be back in a couple of minutes. I'd like to proceed with this topic. If you have more information on it, John, we can go in any direction we want with whatever you're working on.
Okay, great. Let's do it.
And this is Dr. Peter Breggin, And I am really happy to be back online here with my friend, whom I haven't seen in a while, John Rappaport. I was just reading a little bit in the break about what this new project BAM, the brain activity mapping, being prepared, the genome, what it hopes to accomplish. And remember, John and I have been emphasizing that we're just at the tippy edge of even figuring out anything about the brain. And here, one of these scientific estimates is that if we really work on brain mapping, we'll be able to look at the activity of in the neighborhood of 100,000 or more neurons at once in 10 years. So in 10 years, you know, couple hundred thousand neurons. Well, some estimates of the number of neurons go up to 100 billion. Some people say that's way off, it's much lower, but it's in the billions. And the big deal in 10 years is that we may be able to have a way of monitoring a tiny, tiny fraction of what goes on in the brain. It's a nice illustration of what I'm talking about, and John and I are talking about, is that to imagine that we have connections to guilt and shame and anxiety and why you root for the Yankees and I don't, or why one person believes in God and another doesn't, or one's angry and one isn't, or whatever, to connect to human conduct, human thought, feeling, and conduct is so remote. Now, I would love this project if its goals were to fund more neuroscience. I'm not sure it should come from the government, but funding neuroscience itself, it's certainly more important than probably any other branch of study, because it's going to in the hard sciences or the biological sciences. But the corruption is that it won't be studied on a level that doesn't produce products, drugs. All the emphasis is going to go into coming out with saleable products, that is drugs, maybe machines, and social control and psychiatric power. So I don't know, John, how to begin to fight this thing, given that on the one hand, it looks like it's got the saints on its side, and on the other hand, we know it's going to be captured by the forces of the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, one of the ways that I can think of is exactly in line with what you're saying, to document any pharmaceutical involvement and to press on the issue that, as you say, this is all going to be about sellable products. So how can you do what is really basic research when your eye is on the ball of making money and products? And I think there's a certain percentage of people that will understand that when they realize, hey, this is really going to be turned into some sort of horrific commercial venture, and it's not really going to be about pure science at all. So that is one point of attack. And the other, I'm afraid, is going to have to be to try to convince people and show them with the truth that the entire psychiatric apparatus isn't about healing, you know, which is the big one. That it's about making money, gigantic amounts of money. It's about control. It's about power, prestige, and also about social control. And I think people are becoming more aware of that as well, that when they go into a psychiatrist's office and they're given a prescription for a drug and a diagnosis, and all of a sudden they're out the door, and then they have to come back, and are they really taking the drug, and so forth and so on. What is this really? It has nothing to do with traditional concepts of healing. It's about trying to do chemical interventions in people's lives and prove to them in some way that all their behavior goes back to chemicals. I mean, it's like a doctor telling a patient, as I know a doctor did, because I know the patient. She went to him with some problems and so forth, and he said, you basically have an Ativan deficiency, and that's what I'm going to prescribe for you. People are waking up to the con here.
the social control aspects are, have often been kind of abstract in this country. It's not been quite like the USSR or Cuba, where you have the psycho prisons, and if you're a political dissident and it's hard to handle you directly, you just declare that the person has sluggish schizophrenia. That was the phrase in Russia, sluggish schizophrenia. You put him in a psycho prison, give him Haldol, and no longer is he an effective voice in any way at all. And, you know, I've talked about how the social control issues relate to the state hospitals and state clinics, which are basically ways of drugging poor people, people without connections, people without power, people without a family life. How we basically, they were our poorhouses for generations. So that was a little harder for people to get. But now one thing that's getting just so clear with both the left and the right is this idea that psychiatry is going to be our last resort for the social control of violence. So you have Obama coming out with his executive orders, which I've called his, I made a slip once in an email, and it was used in front of millions of people on the air. I made this slip. I wrote to the producer talking about Obama's executive disorders. I didn't mean to do that. And there it was then. I think it was 4 million people listening at any given moment. So President Obama's executive disorders put a lot of emphasis on psychiatry, and so do some of the notes that came out along with those orders, including the encouragement and I think eventually the forcing of healthcare providers to report anybody they suspected being violent, potentially violent, to, quote, authorities, federal authorities. That vague, that terrifying. We have a law in New York State that's just been passed, so that any healthcare provider is supposed to report somebody to the police or other authorities, a patient, if you think they're violent. What this ends up doing is that people who are potentially violent stop talking about it with healthcare providers, which is unfortunate. But, it isn't something that could ever work other than to give a false sense of security. But now that's President Obama. But then you have the NRA calling for a mental health registry, which under Obama's healthcare provisions are going to be developed in these local insurance, these regional insurance centers, these regional centers for collecting, health data are going to be collecting the whole charts with all the psychiatric stuff as well. That's going to be very easy to connect to a mental health registry. I mean, we're really tiptoeing on the edge on both the left and the right now of a more overt use of psychiatry for social control.
Look at what's happening in the James Holmes case with the Aurora massacre, just to illustrate your point here. Okay, so he's been accused as the person who, you know, did all of the killings and woundings in the Aurora Theater last summer. So now his lawyers are probably going to enter an insanity plea. And this means that he'll be sent to a state hospital in Colorado where psychiatrists will determine, you know, what his mental disorder is or whatever they're going to do before he comes back to court to face the judge and see what's going to happen to him. But now the judge has okayed, I mean, this is just astounding, a narco-analytic review that will take place once he enters an insanity plea. And the purpose of this review is to give him, quote, truth drugs to determine what his state of mind really was at the time of the shootings in the theater. In other words, is he just trying to say he's insane when he's not? Will the drugs are purported to be able to loosen him up to the point where perhaps he will blow the whistle on himself and say, well, sure, I knew what I was doing and I planned it all along and so forth and so on, whatever. So under the care of psychiatrists in the state hospital, he will be dosed with who knows what drugs. Forget about, Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate oneself and all of that. But under these drugs, none of which, by the way, have ever proved to be reliable in eliciting the truth from anybody, whether you're talking about sodium pentothal or scopolamine or hypnotic benzodiazepines or whatever, and or LSD or any drug. So I began to look into this because it just seemed so unbelievable to me. And, of course, I saw the CIA MKUltra mind control program connections right away, because when you read the true accounts of that infamous program of trying to control people's minds through drugs and other means, what you discover is that it began supposedly as an effort to develop a truth drug. And they started with cannabis and other things, and none of them were reliable. And then they went to LSD, and that was not reliable either. But they discovered that if you gave a person enough LSD, you could bring him to the point of absolute terror and panic, and then you could get that person to confess anything you wanted them to confess, which is now the USSR program that you alluded to. And so they fastened onto that and thought, well, this is even better. It's so difficult, if not impossible, to get somebody to actually tell the truth under one of these drugs. But if we know the dosage levels, we can give these people incredible drugs like LSD or even more powerful drugs, the hallucinogenics, and put them into such a state of terror where we then say to them, well, if you don't want this to happen to you again, then we want you to tell us the truth, which, by the way, is X, Y, Z. Are you willing to do that? So who knows what's going to happen to this guy when he goes into the Colorado hospital, mental hospital system. And this is just the latest example of crossing the line and using psychiatry, psychiatrists, mind control research, the drugs to put absolute control over people.
Wow, I hadn't heard a word about that.
Yeah, where it's unbelievable. Just look up James Holmes' Narco, and the name itself is fantastic, Narco Analytic Review. The judge
okayed it. Oh, that is amazing. You know, and basically, there are the two classes of drugs that are used for this. One, as you've mentioned, are the hallucinogenics. The old standby, of course, are the just the sedatives. I mean, used to be pentothal, the sedatives. And what they do is you're basically getting the person drunk. So in the one hand, you're either getting them drunk and then hoping he'll get loose lips, when in fact what he's most likely to get is suggestion. Because when you're drunk, you're pretty suggestible and manipulable. You just become, you're not yourself. You don't have the same power anymore as an individual. Or, as you said, terrorized, confused, and frightened, and God knows what you're going to say then to placate people. And this is very old stuff. This goes back a long way and has been so discredited. It's never used in psychiatry anymore. It's been so discredited, yet so eager is psychiatry to move into any niche that reopens up when the public is frightened, that we don't have an outcry from the American Psychiatric Association, and I guess none from the ACLU, which basically, likes to think psychiatry is exempt from all of its criticism because it's for the public good or something. This is just a terrible situation, and we're just going to see more and more of it with this new BAM program, Brain Activity Mapping. It's a really important show, and I'm so glad to give you a voice. You have your own voice, obviously, and have your voice in many places. I mentioned earlier that in part because of my relationship with John, I'm a blogger now on naturalnews.com, Mike Adams' incredible website. And I have, if you go right now to naturalnews.com, you can plug in John, you'll get plenty of John Rappaport stuff. And on the front page is my latest, very relevant blog, just came out, just up now. Find it on the front page. And it's called Never Again, The Real History of Psychiatry. And in there, I talk about something I haven't even brought up on the show, talking about psychiatry as a social abuse, which is the role of psychiatry in Nazi Germany. And I will just, you know, titillate you with the information that a lot of the observers at the Nuremberg trials thought that the Holocaust couldn't have taken place without psychiatry first organizing the extermination of its own mental hospital population, its own psychiatric population, doing it with murder centers, with gas chambers, with wooden soap, with railroad trains, the whole works. First begins with psychiatry organizing its so-called euthanasia or mass murder program. And I've got a cite on there to a scientific article I published in a very good European medical journal, scientific journal, about this program, the German murder program that was initiated by psychiatry. So this is very serious stuff. This is not conspiracy theory in the usual sense of, you know, we got to turn over rocks and connect the worms. This is right out there in history. This is the role psychiatry has played whenever it's been given a chance. In Germany, it took initiative and made the chance for itself and started the first ever systematic, bureaucratic murder program. The first one ever was not the Jewish Holocaust or the Holocaust, the Nazi Holocaust. It was the Prelude, which was the psychiatric Holocaust. This is real stuff, folks.
In that article, by the way, Peter, which I read twice this morning and I've already quoted in a piece that I just wrote, you talk about how this euthanasia program, psychiatric program in Germany, was actually, to a significant degree, imported from the United States, where it was already underway. And you mentioned some incredible things about California, Virginia. I think people need to know about that, too.
Well, just briefly, it begins with the sterilization program in Germany, which was Hitler's first legislation, was sterilization. And, of course, the person who wrote the legislation was the psychiatrist Ernst Rodin. But before they dared go ahead with a national sterilization program, they brought over Americans like Paul Popano, who was in charge of keeping the statistics on California's sterilization program, where they were making discharge for a mental hospital from a mental hospital to be a requirement for discharge had to be sterilization. The Virginia program that went after the mentally disabled children in homes for the retarded and so on. We were carrying out tens of thousands of sterilizations in the U.S. In Germany, the Nazis concluded that, heck, if you could do it in the United States, we're certainly not going to get any opposition from the United States. And then finally, in 1941 and 42, they started debating the issue in the American Psychiatric Association of whether or not we should begin exterminating our population of children with mental disorders, particularly mental retardation. And the American Psychiatric Association, during the height of the murder program in Germany, came out with an editorial favoring the murdering of five-year-old retarded children in America. Psychiatry knows no limits, and this is just incredibly important for people to realize. I give a cite to that in my article, and we had a botch up, and I didn't get a link to that APA editorial. I do have a cite to it, and we're also going to get a link to it if we can.
Yeah, I thought that was absolutely incredible piece of history there. And the thing that I think people have to understand is what's really improved about psychiatry since those days, because people say, well, yes, maybe, okay, but that was a long time ago. No, what's really improved now is the PR. That's the main difference. Now everything is couched in terms of we're here to help, we really care, there's no stigma attached to being diagnosed, Having a mental disorder is no different than having diabetes, et cetera. More research is needed, better treatment, et cetera. And that's what is convincing people that modern psychiatry is in no way connected to these horrors of past psychiatry. But in fact, it's all one continuous history. That's what people have to understand, because the drugs that they're giving people now, as you know, you documented first in Toxic Psychiatry and then in other books that followed, is so horrendous that you're really talking about the same kind of torture that psychiatry is putting people through now as they did in earlier times, except by other means. But it's the same history that's unfolding now. It's just that the public is shielded away from it by the very good public relations machines that are operating.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. In fact, there's really only one revolution in psychiatry. It occurred in the 1930s, and it was when they realized that they needed to do something far, far more extravagant than just whipping people, beating people, dunking people, poisoning people, giving them drugs to make them vomit, giving them drugs to give them diarrhea. They had to do more than that to the state mental patients to control them. And they realized that they could directly assault the brain and get a Nobel Prize for it. So Moniz gets the Nobel Prize, as Portuguese, for lobotomy, which he developed in 36, and then you get electroshock treatment in 38, which we still have with us. We still have some lobotomy in the U.S., and probably hundreds of thousands of shock victims a year in the U.S. alone. And that was the real change. The real change was, let's stop just assaulting the body in our hospitals. Let's go after the brain. And once they could do that, the whole field was open. And now, in a sense, what used to be state mental hospital psychiatry is the psychiatry of everybody. And we have a substantial portion of our children, who knows how many, 15, 20% at any one time with a psychiatric diagnosis and drug. It's an appalling situation, and you are so right that the only thing that changed was the PR. Probably the most successful PR campaign of all time was Eli Lilly, even before Prozac was approved by the FDA, sending docs around the world talking about depression being a biochemical imbalance and how they would now be curing it with a new drug, Prozac. That campaign, biochemical imbalance, got to be the most successful campaign, I think, of all time in the PR, public relations, advertising field. You're right on. John, we got 2 minutes left. You know about being a radio show host, 2 minutes. a couple of your thoughts, sir. It's a marvel having you on.
It's great to be here, Peter.
It's been a really important show.
This conversation has been extremely productive, and I hope that people listening, you know, link their friends and contacts to it, because they're going to get an education out of it. You know, I always try to conclude this by just pointing out, I mean, there are a number of things. I once wrote an article just to parents, don't let your child see a psychiatrist. A simple bottom line, and then I explained exactly why. And in addition to that, I would say, under all, you know, circumstances, we have to preserve the freedom of every individual to refuse to take medication.
If those a great ending, John. John Rappaport, my friend of decades, no more fake news. Look him up. You'll find him easily enough just Googling him. A man of enormous scientific courage and integrity. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Peter, and thank you for all your work. I really appreciate it.